Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your every Monday podcast from the world's greatest living libertarian magazine. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suterman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, work colleagues.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
We're going to have a long conversation today about learning to live with, or attempting to learn to live with, COVID. You might have heard of that virus. But first, are you finding it harder than ever to keep up with the news? Frustrated with paywalls? Irritated by clickbait and pop-up ads? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites. An app that filters out mis- and disinformation while presenting every story from multiple perspectives. An app where journalists scour through the headlines from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. An app, in short, that highlights actual good news so you're not trapped in doom-scrolling despair. All this can be yours from an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L. Inkle.com has inked partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of news feed for just $100 a year. This service gives you access to premium news sites that would otherwise cost you around $12,000. And if you go right the hell now to inkle.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% off. That means you can get a whole year's worth of reliable, headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/podcast. Try today. You'll be glad you did. All right, let's take a snapshot of COVID in the U.S. to set the backdrop for today's convo. The seven-day average for deaths is at around 1,300 right now in the country. That's up from around 300 for most of June and July, though still less than half of what it was like the first 6 weeks of this year. The hottest spots continue to be in the South, particularly Florida, Mississippi, and poor Louisiana, which is also getting hammered by a hurricane just right now. Vaccination rates are 52% for the country and 62% of among those who are eligible to get vaccinated. That's a word, right? 61% have had at least one shot, including 72% of those who are 12 years and older. Meanwhile, most of the country is going back to school now, which means the freakoutery is at a fever pitch. We're going to talk more about that bit later. But there have been a bunch of articles over the past week or so in The Atlantic, The New York Times, and our friend, Dr. Jeff Fisher over at Cato.
Singer.
I do that every time. I do that to his face. Jeff, this is the Fisher King. Anyways, about learning to live.
He's got a strange wound that is casting a sickness upon the land. That might be COVID.
At any rate, Dr. Jeff is talking about, as many other people are, about learning to live with COVID as it becomes endemic rather than pandemic. So I wanted to start today by asking the assembled group of noggins here about just what that would mean and how such an approach would change our policy and our basic approach that we're doing right now. So, Peter, you're both from Florida and in D.C. Why don't you start? How would learning to live with COVID change what we're doing right now?
So I will just talk about one particular policy that affects me personally here in Washington, D.C., which is the second round of D.C.'s indoor mask mandate, which went into effect at the very end of July or the beginning of August. And so, first of all, in a world where you're trying to live with COVID and just you do accept that that it's not going to go away completely, you probably wouldn't have this mask mandate in place in the first place, because there's just not a lot of very solid evidence that mask mandates, and notice I said mandates, not masks themselves, not a lot of solid evidence that they are particularly effective at reducing cases. And so if you look at the studies that have been done of the mandates, of the policies, it's really hard to find very strong evidence that mask mandates are quite good at reducing the number of people who get COVID. And so we would have evidence-based policy, for one thing. But look, we have a more effective tool for limiting spread, and in particular for reducing hospitalization and death, and that's the vaccines. And so we would be focusing on getting people vaccinated rather than on forcing everyone to mask up when they're inside. Though, obviously, individual businesses should be allowed to require masks if they want. But if it is in effect, if we are going to have mask mandates, and unfortunately, I think in some blue states, you know, and cities, that is going to be the reality, at least for the next couple of months, if not for years going forward here. Mandates should have specific goals and an end trigger date or a sunset date to go along with the policy. And so this is something that Mayor Bowser here in Washington, D.C. has refused to do. She put the mask mandate in place and then was asked questions about this, so when is it going to end? What is your plan for ending the mask mandate and going back to how it was actually in, you know, June and July in Washington, D.C.? And she just said, well, we have no information about that at all. We will not provide you with any sort of data. We won't provide you with anything that looks like, okay, here, when we hit these metrics, we are going to lift this thing. Also not going to provide an end date. They have suggested at some point that they maybe would like to have the mask mandate lifted by Thanksgiving. Why Thanksgiving? No idea at all. I don't know. It seems like a nice holiday or something. They should have specific goals, and they should set sunset dates for these policies, and they should set triggers on them, all right? They should be aiming to actually do something specific. And then there should also be reasonable exceptions. And so I would particularly point to, there is a group of gyms in Washington, D.C. that have said, look, Mayor Bowser, we're trying to stop the spread of COVID too. We understand that this is a big priority. And so what we want to do is we want to institute our own system of vaccine verification. And instead of having a mask requirement inside our gyms, we want to make sure that every single person who comes inside in these gyms is vaccinated. And we want to be the ones to verify that, because we take this seriously. One of the gyms that is doing this says they already have evidence that 98%+ of the people who come into their gyms are already vaccinated. And so vaccines, as we've already discussed, are actually very good at reducing the spread of coronavirus and virtually eliminating hospitalization and death. So it would be more effective to have everyone vaccinated than to require masks. And Mayor Bowser was like, nope, we're not going to do any exceptions. So she actually rejected an idea that would have made things more convenient and more comfortable, as well as would have done a better job of preventing the spread of COVID in Washington, D.C. And that's the sort of thing that if you're going to say, let's live with COVID, we're not going to get to COVID zero. Instead, we're going to treat this as an endemic disease that is just going to be with us in some form, like the flu, for the foreseeable future. That's the sort of thing that you're going to need to start thinking about how to have policies that are designed to do specific things, where they have specific announced goals, and where there are risks and trade-offs that can be evaluated, rather than just mandates that get tossed out without any sort of justification, without any end date, without any exceptions, without any sort of sense of what they're there for, and what the trade-offs might be, and what sort of how these things are being balanced by policymakers.
Nick, Dr. Jeff, the Doctor for Liberty, talks about,
what's his last name again,
I'm,
Matt?
I'm just Cooper. Not gonna. I'm not gonna say that with confidence.
Just other medieval professions.
The Kingfisher, Fisher King,
Smith,
Jeff Singer.
Anyways, he talks about a harm reduction strategy. Not everyone is familiar with said term. Can you walk us through what that means, what its history is, and its applicability to the current crisis?
Sure. Harm reduction strategies to public health have to do, they are implicitly, I would argue, implicitly libertarian, in the sense that they are not utopian. They do not say, for instance, when we're talking about drug prohibition, instead of saying we're going to wipe out all drug use, all drug traffic and things like that, instead, harm reduction approaches to public health issues take the approach that adults are going to do certain types of behavior, and actually all policy needs to be realistic. And instead of trying to have a utopian perfect goal, you work with what's possible. Harm reduction approaches in drug treatment, in recovery, instead of pushing an idea of absolute abstinence under all and every circumstance, it says people are likely to continue to use drugs, and what are ways in which we minimize the risks they put themselves in or people around them. The term first became popular in public health during the 80s in relation to the AIDS crisis, where it focused on things like safe needle exchanges and allowing people to come forward with AIDS or to continue in kind of behaviors, whether it was sexual or particularly IV drug use, and figuring out ways to make things safer. So things like safe sex and injection sites are examples of harm reduction strategies. And I think what's good about it here, and this, you know, dovetails obviously with what Peter was talking about, is that when we make the switch from saying the goal is to have no one anywhere ever again get COVID, which would imply some kind of, you know, John Travolta, boy in the plastic bubble, shrink wrap society where we are alone forever in our pods or in our, you know, in our own rooms, in our own houses, et cetera. Rather, you come up with ways that allow people to make as many choices as possible, to understand and then assess their own risk levels. And you distribute the ability of people to kind of figure out ways to live with this. And it would be more like accepting COVID-19 as something like the flu. It is something that will be here. There will be particularly tough flare-ups. A lot of the times it will go, you know, unremarked upon after a certain point, and we learn to live with it. And we do certain common sense things like promoting vaccines, which are absolutely overwhelmingly powerful in reducing the harms caused by COVID. And we worry less about getting the last case done by having mask mandates, which have, little data to support themselves as a way of dealing with things. So.
Nick pointed to letting people make their own choices. I would just sort of add to that, that the role that public health authorities play, to the extent they are playing one here, should be focused on providing information to people so that they can make informed choices about trade-offs. And I think that's really been something that has been hugely lacking in our COVID policy and COVID personal choice discussion, is that there are obviously trade-offs in making decisions about what you're going to do each day. There are also trade-offs in policymaking. We should try to resolve those down to the individual when possible. But either way, we should say, look, here's what we're willing to sacrifice, if anything, and here's why, in order to accomplish X specific goal. And then if we don't accomplish that goal, we can judge that idea was a failure. But right now we have no even real sort of stated specific goals from so many of our policymakers. They're just not saying why they are doing the things they are doing and what they hope to accomplish. And so that makes it almost impossible for you to say, well, you didn't even, you know, for you to actually measure and judge these policies in any sort of objective way.
This is one of the, if I may, just very quickly, part of the problem is that public health as a concept has been creeping towards a utopian ideal of doing things like getting rid of all smoking rather than finding a level that we can live with and giving people information and alternatives like vaping. A harm reduction approach to cigarette smoking is to actually allow and even encourage vaping, which by everybody's accounting is a much safer alternative to delivering nicotine to people who want it. But instead, early on, the public health officials in America said, you know what, vaping looks like smoking, so we are going to ban it everywhere we have banned smoking. And the result is that you get a stall out in the number of people who are going to switch to a healthier alternative. And so it's really important, I think, to look at COVID not as a unique phenomenon when it comes to public health and public policy, but rather it is an example and an ongoing movement away from being realistic and about minimizing things to trying to extirpate them completely. And any utopia, you know, ends, you know, the attempt to make heaven on earth results in creating hell on earth, as Karl Popper once said.
Let's let the editor-in-chief of Reason talk on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Catherine, let's talk about your sense of what happens when we shift the focus from the pandemic to the endemic. And maybe even if you so choose, you can relate this to rockets, which we might talk about later in the podcast as well, but just in terms of an adult approach towards risk assessment.
I always want to relate things to rockets. I'm not sure that the answer I had in mind is especially rocket analogy friendly, but I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, Catherine, how is getting COVID like riding a rocket?
You might die. So that actually is whatever. Okay, let me try and answer the question. So I think that the other piece of living with COVID and understanding that it's not going away is something that's actually really hard for people who want to solve problems, right? And that is that we are going to have to find ways to accept and live with people who can't or won't get vaccinated. This is something that it was reasonable enough for us to say, listen, we're going to push really hard and try to solve the problem of COVID with vaccination. We have this vaccine. It's a medical miracle that we have it so quickly. Let's do everything we can to get people vaccinated. And we've now basically hit a ceiling on that. Like, more people will get vaccinated, but it is clear that, like, the poor, the unvaccinated will always be with us. And so we need to find a way to both handle the risks that unvaccinated people pose and also to find ways for unvaccinated people to participate in society. I think there are a lot of people out there who are just like, fine, don't get a vaccine, never leave your house again. But that is an unrealistic and absolutist way of approaching the problem. Among other things, there are some people who aren't getting vaccines because they can't, not because they're assholes, but because they can't, because they are scared for good reasons about the vaccine. Now, to be clear, let's do the disclaimer. Most people should not be scared of the vaccine. The vaccine is very safe and very effective, but there are people who have legitimate concerns. Some ways to accommodate that include stuff like what Delta Airlines has done, which is to say, listen, you can continue to work at Delta unvaccinated, but you have to pay more for your health insurance because we anticipate that you will cost us more. Delta self-insures, so it makes sense in their case. This aligns everyone's incentives properly. This is harder for companies or institutions that have third-party insurers. It doesn't quite work out the same way. So that solution won't work for everyone. But I think that's a really interesting model. I also think making testing available. I think that being able to show that you have antibodies in some way that is broadly socially accepted would be useful for people who already had COVID. So I guess I want us to accept that the unvaccinated exist and figure out how to build social institutions that accommodate them, because we can't, it is not plausible, in the same way that it's not plausible to say, okay, our plan is no one's ever going to do heroin again, right? Like, great plan, not going to happen. Like, my plan is everyone get vaccinated, but I recognize that that is not going to happen. And so we need to build policy that accepts that there are unvaccinated people in the population and to both have them hold their own risk to the extent that that's possible, to carry the costs that they are imposing themselves, but also because hopefully we're good and compassionate people, to allow people who are unable to get vaccinated to still participate in society.
I would add, in my category of how behavior might change with this approach, I would love to see the behavior of journalism and media institutions change, or at least sort of retilt a little bit. There's been pretty good studies talking about how the United States media compared to counterparts throughout the rest of the world that's been measured is way, way more relentlessly negative in coverage. And not that you have to like wake up and say, I'm going to do it positively. But one thing that you could do differently is maybe not have such a high proportion of headlines, leads, and focuses on stories be things like parents are freaking out about school, which is true. It's important. It's a fact. It's a news story that parents are freaking out about school. But you can also do journalism that talks about the actual context of the stuff that they're freaking out and sort of measure data in addition to the anecdotes that might tell a different story rather than make those all kind of question marks. Is it safe to go back to school? Question mark. Like, you can, there's data that points towards directional things about that. I see, and it's very frustrating to me that sort of have to write the same article every August, probably have to do it next August as well. But media is making it harder, not easier, to assess risk right before the school year starts. And that shouldn't be the case. It should be easier to read an article and come out thinking, I know more information that's usable
you
to me.
Pie in
about
the sky
this.
Dreamer. You crazy guy. The journalism's providing the information.
Maybe we need to do journalism harm reduction here.
Move to the Czech Republic.
Where like, instead of expecting journalism, if your plan is for, like, all journalism to provide useful context, okay, great plan. Let's get back to reality.
Except that a lot of journalism is garbage. I mean, I do think the one tidbit that really would be helpful in Matt's project here is if articles about outbreaks did not just include the number of cases, just that minimum thing. Like, I just read an article about a school where there were a bunch of kids that got COVID from a teacher. Okay, what happened to those kids? Are they totally fine? That might be worth including in the article. Like, not just cases, but severe cases and deaths. Like, that should just be mandatory at this point because there are so many vaccinated people in the population that case numbers are not the same thing as massive social cost.
Let's actually follow up with schools, and so that's where a lot of this debate is happening right now. As I mentioned at the top, 75% of the country is already back at school, which, I mean, it's August, Nick. That's not how they did it in the 70s,
kids,
man.
Today.
We didn't have with school.
We always started before Labor Day, Matt Welch,
you
in New Jersey.
In Virginia,
no
rumor was
wonder.
That we had, it was the King's Dominion rule, which I don't know if that's real, which was that because the amusement park lobby was so powerful in Virginia. I swear to God, this was like lore that kids told each other that school didn't open until after Labor Day because they wanted to maximize.
It's totally Northern Virginia lore being about lobbyists
Most of my childhood lore was about like the military industrial complex. So, you know, that's how it is to grow up here.
Yeah. It's North versus South as well. You know, the Southern school started later. Stayed in school later.
Thank you.
This sounds like one of those things like the daylight savings time justification too, though, where it's like you just make up. It's like, well, the farming kids needed to wake up earlier for the what? Like, it's not real.
Merely before and after Labor Day.
Let's talk about specific policy about all this. United States continues to be an outlier in terms of what its federal government and health agencies recommend about kids being masked. The CDC recommends that kids 2 years and older are masked whenever they're in sort of indoor group settings. In most countries, elementary school children are not being given masks. In fact, you'll have public health people in Britain saying, no, but that's a terrible idea. The cost benefit is really bad for kid development. So that's all an outlier. But we're also an outlier in terms of we don't set policies about schools from the federal government or the national government. They're done on state and local levels. So you have all these different warring mandates. You must have a mask. You must not have a mask, et cetera, playing out. A huge disparity of or variety of regimes out there. Los Angeles has arguably the most elaborate and expensive system. They're testing every single kid and employee of the LA Unified School District every week, a COVID test, whether you're vaccinated or not, vaccined or not. And that's 500,000 tests every single week. And to Catherine's point, I wrote about it last week, that's getting a lot of headlines about the raw number of positive tests. As opposed to like the raw number divided by 500,000. But anyways, in LA and like New York, which just announced its policy last week where my kids go to school, a single kid tests positive regardless of their level of illness. Not only are they sent home, but everybody in their class who is unvaccinated is also sent home for a period of time. So you have sort of these multiples of quarantining. Catherine, I'm wondering, since your kids have been in school for 5 weeks or whatever by now, how does school policy, how is that playing out in the greater D.C. area? And what's your kind of sense of prognosis for the upcoming school year being marred by COVID and COVID policy?
So my kids actually start school today, and I will let you know how things go. But,
hey,
you know, I think that there's also this weird phenomenon. I don't know if you've seen this in New York, where technically the CDC's guidelines interpreted a certain way. You can basically say if a kid was in a classroom with a mask on and taking other precautions, that even if another kid in that class does have COVID, they weren't exposed. Like, there's a weird, like, Orwellian, like, we're just redefining all the terms. So it's like, you would think being in a room with someone with COVID would count as an exposure. But maybe if we just don't count that, we don't have to keep closing school. So there's like a whole bunch of weird stuff happening on that front right now. I had the thought, which is probably a bad one, but let me just go ahead and say it on our podcast, which is that rules about masking, to me, have a lot of parallels with the fight over critical race theory. So let's do this. It is both having children mask all day long in low-risk environments is dumb, and I think teaching critical race theory is dumb. I don't think that either of those are good ways to encourage good, solid, healthy child development and have a healthy school environment. However, the more pernicious thing is not the mask wearing or the teaching of critical race theory. The more pernicious thing is trying to resolve debates over those things using politics at the highest level. So a national mandate about mask wearing or critical race theory would be the greatest sin. A state level mandate about masking or critical race theory, either direction, would be the greatest sin. We might still have lots of schools or school districts that ultimately make decisions that I don't like, but the closer we get to individual decision making, the better on both masking and critical race theory. Did that work? I don't know. It might have worked.
So can I ask then, is it a bad idea to have a national application of the First Amendment?
Like, really?
Let's table that thought for the moment. Nick, my question.
No, it is. Because, I mean, I think there needs to be, at the same time, obviously we want people to be making decisions, political or individual, at the closest level to the people making the decision. But we also have to have a really strong discussion about what is the best policy. And like, there's a ton of people who are anti-vax, who are idiots and are anti-scientific, and then they are using whatever means possible to be like, well, you know, the science is bad, or it's my choice, or it's this, or it's that. And you have all of these different arguments going on. I think it's important to have like clear, conscious discussions about what is the best way possible. What do the vaccines do? What do they don't do, et cetera? Because that is going to inform the decisions that are made at the local level.
The Bill of Rights.
And that is analogous to having a First Amendment saying, you know what, Mississippi can't ban speech anymore.
The Bill of Rights is instituted to secure rights from government. That's different than establishing policies for vaccines. I just think it's a category difference. But Nick, let's follow up. With the LA example, they're spending $350 million this year. One school district. A lot of it's county money.
That's money they could be spending on iPad replacements for the hundreds of millions of iPads.
Oh, yeah. Remember that?
Dollars in iPads.
Or they on critical race theory consultants.
True. That's a lot of, copies of.
Yeah, how many Robin nice DiAngelo racism. Lectures could you buy for $350 million?
Is that, do you think, money well spent when it's being tested, including people who've been vaccinated?
No.
Okay.
No, and again, this is also, you know, the real case that needs to be made in the LA Unified School District, as well as other ones, is first and foremost, because kids are unlikely, you know, relatively statistically speaking, they're unlikely to get COVID or transmit it or have bad outcomes from it. It's still, what is it? I was looking this up in Dr. Jeff Singer's wonderful Cato report. But as of July, only 358 kids under 17 have died of COVID-19. You know, kids are not the problem. The LA Unified School District should be talking with its idiot teachers who are making all kinds of noise about, oh, well, you got to wear a mask, but don't make us get vaccinated and things like that. And that's the conversation that the idiot leaders of the LA Unified School District should be having with their idiot staff, which is always and everywhere about being in the classroom less and teaching less. But that's the conversation, not spending $350 million to test a bunch of kids who it doesn't even matter if they get the disease, generally speaking.
They have a vaccine mandate there that goes into final effect on October 15th, FYI. Peter, the CDC is all in a lather.
By the way, see if that happens. Okay.
The CDC is all in a lather over a case, speaking of vaccinated teachers and lack thereof, in Marin County from May, in which a teacher, as per the Washington Post reporting on this, was masked all day except when she was reading to her class, and she read to her class for 20 minutes, and then the first two rows of the class all got infected. And so this is freaking people out about how the Delta variant is burning like wildfire through, and that's quotes from the story, through the unvaccinated populations of elementary school kids. Is that a odd case to base current panic
Well, I'll
on.
Just read you a sentence or two from the Washington Post report. On May 19th, one teacher, not named, who was not vaccinated against the coronavirus began feeling fatigued and had some nasal congestion. She dismissed it as allergies and powered through. While she was usually masked, she made an exception for story time so she could read to the class. That seems totally reasonable about your mask, but there's like a phrase in there that's important. Who was not vaccinated against the coronavirus. And look, vaccination does not prevent transmission, but the evidence we have is that especially with the variants, the pre-Delta variants that were spreading more commonly in May, although in, I suppose in this case, we're pretty confident that this is a case of Delta, vaccination, first of all, prevents you from, it makes it less likely, I should say, that you will get the coronavirus in the first place. And so if you don't get it, you can't spread it. And then second of all, if you do get it, it tends to make the cases more mild and make transmission, it tends to reduce transmission at least somewhat, right? So we're now, you know, the CDC is talking up this story for which there is an easy fix, which is that teachers could be vaccinated. And, you know, look, it was the middle of May. People were still trying to figure out how to get vaccinated in some cases. But by that point, just about everybody in the country had an opportunity to go get vaccinated for free, to at least have gotten their first shot. And
especially teachers
in particular, who negotiated all over the country opportunities to get vaccination early and to jump the line, which in some ways made sense if you were going to put them in rooms full of kids for prolonged periods. It didn't make sense if you were not going to put them in rooms full of kids for prolonged periods, or if the teachers were not going to take up the offer to get vaccinated before everyone else, especially early on when there were limited supplies.
Let's go to our email of the week here in a moment. But first, living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, you might think that online privacy and privacy was a thing of the past. Well, think again, comrades. Did you know that there's a better way to protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing, massaging your private pixels and bits? Introducing secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email services hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws have force. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other privacy dismembering laws. Your email and instant messaging services will be safe from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google. Take back your privacy and online security with Secure by going to secure.com. That is SEKUR.com. You'll be glad you did. All right. Again, as I said last week, I think there's too many good emails chasing too few spots. Thank you for them. Keep them coming to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from loyal listener and supporter. Thank you for that. Ted Shaft. Can you dig it? He writes, I think you are missing a huge opportunity to advance the party by not placing the blame for the Afghanistan fiasco squarely on the shoulders of the 97% of Americans who continue to vote for Democrats and Republicans. The choice offered is $1 trillion or $980 billion military budget, when including the VA. We have allowed politicians to fearmonger and politicize terrorism and define patriotism as being for only those who support huge military footprints around the world. What say you, supported Catherine?
I am always happy to miss an opportunity to advance the party because that's not my goal. No, I mean, this question, the heart of this question is in the right place. Yeah, it completely sucks that we have a broad-based bipartisan consensus in this country that war in Afghanistan was like soup's a good idea for freaking 20 years, like disgusting, a nightmare. I'm happy that there are politicians, including those in the Libertarian Party, who opposed the war on principle and did so consistently over that period. But I think blaming everyone in America who votes for a mainstream political party, which, by the way, is not 97% of the country because most people don't vote like me, you know, blaming them for this war, I think, misses a lot of what's going on, including that, you know, there were lots of mechanisms available outside of the electoral context. There are lots of mechanisms outside of who wins office that could have influenced whether or not we got into this war and whether or not we stayed in this war, and that elections are only a small piece.
Nick, isn't there some, you know, bad Rolling Stones lyrics interpretation here? First of all, that it's not actually been a popular war. It's been a very unpopular war for a long time. Just people aren't moved enough to influence their politicians to do something about it. So like, you know, the after all, it was you and me is not necessarily with direct sympathy, but lack of motivation to do a damn thing about it, particularly after, you know, Barack Obama got elected.
Is that a open invitation to talk about Sirhan Sirhan getting paroled?
Absolutely,
Matt Welch,
is.
Because
thank you.
After all, he killed the Kennedy, not you or me.
Oh, that is so good.
Right?
Fold in a Rosie Greer reference.
But having said this, you know, to the reader's letter, you know, what is great news is that one of the great libertarian victories of the past 20 years is that anti-war sentiment is now extremely widespread. And I think it is the backdrop. It's the consensus of foreign policy. Nobody believes anymore, oh, you know what, like nation building is a good idea. Invading and occupying countries with the goal of securing freedom for the people living there and safety from terrorism in the U.S. of A. by being over there. Nobody is buying that anymore, or fewer and fewer people are. The real question going forward now, you know, as we exit Afghanistan, and within a couple of weeks, we won't ever be talking about Afghanistan ever again. You know, one of the most interesting stats was that I saw was how basically over the previous 5 years, national news broadcasts, which are still rumored to exist, spent like 5 minutes, you know, in 5 years talking about Afghanistan. It's a big story now because we're withdrawing. But the broader, you know, win is that we have a different understanding of foreign policy and military interventionism. And the real question for, I think, for reason, for libertarians, for politicians going forward is how do we learn to use this to guide foreign policy going forward? Because at this point, we've only come to this understanding after 2+ disastrous wars, including various kinds of interventions that are still ongoing in Syria and Yemen, to name but two. So that's, you know, we've won, and now we have to make sure that we remember this and keep it forward as the Biden administration, the Kamala Harris presidency begins, and whatever, you know, new hell awaits us in 2024.
Peter, Matt Taibbi in his weekly newsletter or whatever it is that he does, Substackian, whatever, suggested on Friday that what we really need is a third party, regardless of its political stance, doesn't take money from military contractors, and that the money from military contractors warps all, directs all, is all powerful. Do you think that he's being naive, or is there something to that?
In general, I am skeptical when someone says the solution to a problem is a political party, either one that exists or doesn't. I think, in some ways, I agree with Catherine. I think this commenter's, this listener's letter is, heart is in the right place in a lot of ways, right? It suggests that the fiasco is on the shoulders of the 97% of Americans who continue to vote for Democrats and Republicans. I wouldn't quite put it that way. What I would say is it is on the shoulders of Democrats and Republicans, of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the leadership there. And to me, a huge part of the problem with American politics, and I would definitely sort of put a lot of our sort of foreign policy failures in this category here, is just the way the parties themselves operate. And they're gonna, and the parties aren't going to be fixed by not taking money from Boeing. They take money from Boeing because, in some ways, because they already agree with what Boeing's doing. And there is a there's a symbiotic relationship there. It's not just that the military industrial complex is buying, you know, in a kind of straightforward way, support from the parties. And so a third party that didn't take money from the, you know, the big defense corporations, I just have a real hard time seeing how it would actually solve the problem that Matt Taibbi is solving. That said, I would like to reduce the influence of big defense corporations who have a vested interest in the United States, in the United States continuing to spend hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars every year on in many cases, wasteful and needless defense contracting.
We're going to get pretty soon to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. But first, Catherine got really excited this morning about rockets. I know that's crazy.
That's unfortunate.
That's crazy. So I want to let her do her rocket thing. Catherine, what happened this weekend and why are you all excited?
I do have rocket news, and I think that there are maybe some broader lessons in the my rocket news. So first of all, we had a successful SpaceX launch. SpaceX, it's their 90th launch with this configuration. They have a new drone ship that they landed on. They sent up some avocados and some ant farms or something, because that's what we do at the International Space Station still. It feels like we could do better, but we'll get to that. But there was also a failed launch. Astra is a rocket company that this was their third attempt. And when the vehicle left the launch pad, it moved sideways. Like, I really recommend that you go look at this footage, because it's shocking. The thing just like scooches sideways for a while in a fiery cloud and then manages to correct and actually take off and like disappear into the beautiful Alaska, you know, sky. And what everybody saw was a failure. But what actually happened was they got a huge amount of information. Like, this is what Elon Musk is always saying, is like, a failed launch is still a success if we learn something. And I think like the, you know, the fact that this rocket was able to right itself and still take off is frankly pretty wild and something to sort of admire in the industry. But also, Astra is publicly traded. They did a SPAC, and their stock lost money. Like, everybody looked at that mess and was like, oh no, maybe my investment in this company isn't a good idea. And that's how it should be. When you have a bad launch, what should happen is not you hope a bunch of congressmen don't notice and defund you. It should be like, maybe your investors lose confidence in you and they invest in your competitors instead. So a little bit of like commercial rocketry for your weekend, but I do recommend you go watch video of the Astra launch, because it is wild to see.
And thus ends the parable of the commercial rocket launch by Catherine Mangu-Ward. You should do a weekly little 3-minute
gather around children for the rocket launch parable segment of our show.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming. Suderman, why don't you lead us off?
So I've been listening, obviously, to Donda, the new album by Kanye West. It's phenomenal, and it's finally actually here, at least for the moment. So this thing has been a long time coming. Kanye has been teasing this in some form for over a year. And this is in some ways kind of standard behavior for Kanye West, who will often be like, I've got an album coming out real soon. And 18 months later, he'll be like, I've got an album coming out real soon. And there's still no album. And maybe it's completely changed titles and track lists and all this stuff. But then at the end of July, of this year, of this summer, he said, look, it's not just coming, it's coming in like 3 days. It was like a Tuesday or a Wednesday afternoon, and he was like, it's coming out Friday, and Thursday night, I'm going to play the album for a crowd at a stadium in Atlanta. So a bunch of people showed up in Atlanta, and also a bunch more people showed up in their living rooms to watch him play the album for people in a stadium on Apple the TV live stream, something or other. And so you could hear this thing. And my gosh, it was kind of a mess the first time he played it. And then the next day came around, and we were like, okay, well, I guess we're going to get to check that out and see what it's actually like when it releases, except we didn't. because it didn't come out. And then, like, through, like, some seventh-level intermediary, like the friend of a radio DJ in, I don't know, some other state or something, maybe, I forget exactly, there was, like, a word that was like, okay, Kanye's not actually, he's going to release this, but he's just decided he's not ready yet. And the Jay-Z verse that you heard last night at 9 p.m., it was only recorded at 4 p.m. that day, so he's still going to tweak all this stuff, and he's going to do this again in, like, 2 weeks. So he set up another live performance at a stadium in Atlanta and played the album again, except this time it was a different album. And also there were a bunch of crazy dancers, and Kanye got shot into the sky via like a basically like a giant human rubber band situation at the end of it. And it was really kind of weird and crazy in just the best possible way. But once again, the album was scheduled to come out the following day. There were even like listing pages in the Apple Music store. And once again, the following day came and the album did not. And then he did this a third time last week in I believe, Chicago, where he built a life-size mock-up of his childhood home in the middle of a stadium. And played the album again. And of course, each time, it's a completely different album, right? It's not completely different. Like, some of the songs are the same, but they're in a different order. They've got a different mix. There's different arrangements, different guest verses. Like, this thing is just sort of, it's never stable and it's always changing. But it was going to come out the day after that, and then it didn't. But it did come out Sunday. Okay, so it came out. This thing came out, and it's an hour and 48 minutes long. It's got like 26 or 27 tracks. And I say 26 or 27 because within a couple of hours of it being released, one of the tracks that was released on this thing was pulled from release. And there was like, it's totally unclear why this happened. Kanye released a thing saying, actually, I didn't want this album to come out. The studio released this without my permission, and then they wouldn't let me release this other track, Jail 2, which has a guest verse on it. There's something about some sort of clearance issue with the guest rapper and the guest rapper's manager. And then this morning, I checked in again, and that's the song that had been pulled is back on the album. So this thing, it's out. And it's not out. And I'm like, I'm really looking forward to this next week or month or year where this album just kind of changes every day. And we're like watching Kanye make the album in real time somehow or another. I didn't even mention all of the live stream videos of Kanye in like depressing little cinder block windowless rooms inside the stadium in Atlanta where he was supposedly finishing the album. And he'd like taped up a little tiny sign on the door saying like Kanye's studio or something. And it's just like a tiny mattress on a crappily carpeted floor and like a little laptop with two, you know, monitors next to it. And it's just so bonkers and so delightfully crazy. And I love that Kanye is bringing the whole world into his madness. And he's doing it in the form of the art that he is the greatest at. I don't particularly care for a lot of his personal drama, the clothes, the whole sort of the rest of the image, whatever, like the whole kind of Kanye vibe is not something I care about that much, but his music is just consistently incredible. And this album is incredible. It is a work of crazy, sprawling genius in some ways. I don't know that it's his best album, but it might be his like most deeply Kanye album, the thing that is the most himself. Because like there's songs on this that he's just like, well, here's sort of two versions of the song that are like on the one hand the same and on the other hand completely different. And you can kind of take your pick of which one you like better, right? There's a sort of sketchpad aspect to this. At the same time, even like the songs that are just that feel like here's a little track, a little riff that I worked on one evening and didn't bother to ever develop or finish, those songs still have a depth and layeredness to them, a kind of a sonic complexity that is just unrivaled in pop music these days. And, you know, it just kind of, it brings to mind, there was a social science paper that went around a couple of months ago, I want to say, sometime this summer, about how like elite taste is now not about liking the right genre of things, but liking the best examples, the consecrated examples from each genre, right? And so you would sort of like a little bit of country, but only the really good country, and a little bit of hip hop, but only the really good stuff. And Kanye is the really good hip hop, guys. He is doing the same stuff that all of these other like kind of trap guys who are, you know, just sort of making basic top 40 rap that is designed to be enjoyed like at a barbecue, whatever. He's taking those that same set of sounds, and then he is mixing them with like classical cinematic film score, and on this album in particular, a huge amount of gospel influences. And it's just so wonderful to listen to someone, to listen to music that is so thoughtfully made and so wild, and also is so deeply weird and personal. Strongly recommend. If you like music, play it loud.
Nick, you don't like music. What have you been consuming?
Oh, sorry. I just spent the past couple of hours building a house in my living room, and I'm about to start recording.
Yeah, that's prudent.
I have been watching the Hulu series from David Kelly, starring, among other people, I have absolutely forgotten her name at this point because I
went
into
matter.
A fugue state, I think. But
that was your
Nicole
weekend,
Kidman.
Nick.
You know, I felt like I was reliving it. I had an extra day there for the past 15 minutes or so. It was Nine Perfect Strangers with Nicole Kidman, the former and possibly future Mrs. Tom Cruise. It's a interesting show that is, you know, was shot during the pandemic, and like many shows in the pandemic, The White Lotus is like this as well, which I talked about previously, where, you know, it's kind of a bunch of people have to come together and they're stuck in a situation as a kind of stagecoach drama. And this one is at a wellness, like a hippy dippy, wellness, you know, spa. And it's four of the six episodes have been released. It's rolling out weekly on Hulu, and it has a psychedelic twist that I won't go into to avoid spoiling. But it's an intriguing show that has a bunch of odd characters who are assembled, who are dosed with psychedelics, and then, you know, hilarity and insight. And ultimately, I think disappointment ensues. One of the things I was talking about with some people over the weekend was how episodic TV is great now. I mean, there's so much of it. But typically, you know, the first two-thirds of a limited series are fantastic, and then it starts to really shit the bed. And this one has a lot of, you know, I'm getting that sense from this, but I want to stick it out with 2 hours to go. So I've been watching Nine Perfect Strangers. You can catch up the next episode. The fifth episode drops, I believe, on Wednesday. And it's a, you know, it's an intriguing kind of diversion from the hell of Earth.
For fans of, like, if you give us a comparison here.
It's like the Kanye album.
A little bit less labored. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I am consuming a podcast from Gimlet Media and Pineapple Street, which is called Welcome to Your Fantasy. And it is the history of Chippendales. The Chippendales dancers. And it's weirdly delightful. I cannot for the life of me remember who recommended this podcast to me. Somebody looked me in the eyes and said, Catherine, you will enjoy this podcast series about the history of Chippendales. And they were right. And I don't know who it was.
Audio of Chippendales.
Yeah. Yes. That's why it's great.
Yeah.
You
what
literally,
is the audio? Just it's oil swishing.
There's a lot
the
of
air?
Actually it has like an original soundtrack that's very good. That's very like evocative of the era. And then there's like a lot of women screaming. Like there's a lot of and there's some excellent, you know how people sounded, especially on TV and like Man on the Street interviews in the 80s? Like there's that weird voice that people had, and it's like, and how? Like it's like this, I can't even do it. But there's so much great 80s voice. So I really recommend it for that. There's also in passing, sort of one of the stars of the podcast is this woman, Candace, who is a producer on Chippendales and who seems to have been responsible for a lot of the particular aesthetic, like the oiled chest flowing mullet vibe is like that's Candace's work. And the producer visits her in her home, which is filled with Chippendales paraphernalia, and she casually mentions a bunch of Ayn Rand-related paraphernalia.
Wow.
Like, side by side on the shelves. So, like, somewhere in here, we can tell a story about how Ayn Rand created Chippendales or something. This podcast does not tell that story, but it is nonetheless a good podcast. It's got a behind the music structure, right? The rise, the moment of, you know, peak cultural influence, and then the squabbling, the drugs, and the eventual downfall. So
does Channing Tatum make an appearance?
You know, I haven't actually got to, I assume that like the legacy of Chippendales in the person of Channing Tatum will emerge. I'm
he
not quite done with it.
He was a male dancer. He didn't just play one in Magic Mike. He actually did the job before he was a famous
method,
actor.
Very method.
Does John Stagliano show up at all? The pornographer, the head of Evil Angel, who was an early Chippendales dancer.
Incredible. No, I have not finished it yet, so I will return to this podcast if either John Stagliano or Channing Tatum make important appearances in ways that our listeners
or
should know
Ayn
about.
Rand.
Or Ayn Rand.
Make you want to go back and watch Magic Mike again.
No.
It should, because it's a great movie.
No. But the, you know, among other things, there's a great after-the-fact grafting on of a feminist agenda. So basically, like, there was some dudes with a nightclub that was doing very badly, and they were like, fine, on Wednesday nights in our totally empty club, let's try this male strip show. And it takes off. And then later... there's one point where one of the principals tells one of the producers for the podcast that Chippendales is the reason she's allowed to wear pants. Like he's like really claiming a lot for the like women's lib elements of Chippendales. But, yeah, you know, the podcast remains skeptical, but not entirely dismissive of that thesis. And I think that's right. So if you are interested in, I don't know,
why women wear pants,
flowing mullets, Ayn Rand, or why women wear pants, this is the podcast for you.
So I spent much of my bonus culture consumption time last week going through the mourning process of the death of Charlie Watts, the great Rolling Stones drummer. And the chief delivery for that was listening to the Stones' late 70s records in a row. Black and Blue, Some Girls, Emotional Rescue, Tattoo You, which they're New York records. And I did that because not only they're pretty great, although it's not like the most classic run of Stones, but because since it was the 70s and they were playing some disco and that kind of stuff, the drums are up really high in the mix, and they're really great. And also, maybe you haven't heard those songs 50 trillion times. And so it's kind of fresh to get. So in that, and I thought I'd kind of work my way through, and just what a marvelous drummer he was. Last night, a listener to this podcast, Tony Biasotti, he's a journalist out in the West Coast of the United States, posted a thing saying, why didn't anyone tell me about disc two of the Some Girls 2-disc deluxe edition that came out 10 years ago? This is a great Stones album. And he put a song in there and I listened to it, which I hadn't heard before. And I know the Stones pretty well. And it was indeed great. So what happened is that the Some Girls recordings, which were done, I think, in 1977, they produced so much excess stuff that the Tattoo You record, which is a huge, gigantic record, is largely like Some Girls outtakes or just outtakes that they had in the late 70s when everyone was on heroin and stuff and they were making good music in New York. And so Mick Jagger went back in just before 2010 and said, look, we have all this great sounding music. The vocals and the lyrics aren't necessarily so good. And so he recorded, he wrote new verses, recorded vocals on them because he's mostly kept his voice circa late 70s, at least to these days. He drinks a lot of tea and even doing like the harmonies to make him sound like Keith, because Keith obviously can't sing like that anymore. And it's actually really good. So Some Girls Deluxe Disc 2, 12 songs that unless you're a total Stones head, you haven't heard. And they're really kind of great. It is a great Stones album on itself. Weird mix of country and kind of reaction to punk and disco, which is kind of what Some Girls is like. Super good. So give it a listen and respect out to the best dressed drummer in the history of rock and roll, Mr. Charlie Watts. That's all the rock and roll we have time for on this podcast. Keep on listening. We will be back with you not on next Monday, but on next Tuesday, because we are supporting Labor Day here at the Reason Foundation, which publishes this podcast. Listen to all of our podcasts, reason.com/podcast. And thank you. Goodbye.